Before we get into today's episode, I want to invite you on a unique spiritual journey this Advent season. It's called Journey to Bethlehem, and it's a free 9-day text message series designed to prepare your heart for Christmas. Starting on December the 17th, and each day leading up to Christmas, you'll receive a short reflective message pointing you to the hope, peace, joy, and love found in the coming of Christ. It's completely free and a great way to keep your focus on Jesus this season. Sign up today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now here's today's podcast.
Before the rush takes over, start your Christmas journey with Premier's Advent Moments interactive calendar. Open each door and step into the unfolding story of Jesus with daily challenges rooted in kindness and a verse that brings you closer to Bethlehem. You'll also receive short emails of encouragement to help you stay centered through Advent. Sign up at premier.org.uk/advent2025. Brought to you by Sat7 UK. Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And we're very pleased to say we have a guest on the show today, which is Nigel Bigger. How are you, Nigel?
I'm fine, Tim. Glad to be with you both.
For those who haven't come across you before, Nigel, would you mind introducing yourself and just saying a little bit about who you are? I think you are the first person to ever appear on this podcast while calling in from the House of Lords.
yes, of course, Tim. So I'm Anglo-Scottish. I wasn't brought up in a Christian household. I became a Christian in my first act of rebellion at the age of 13. I became a career academic. My last post, which I retired from 3 years ago, was a professor of moral theology or Christian ethics at the University of Oxford. And then, yes, in January of this year, 2025, I entered the UK House of Lords as a legislator.
Wonderful. So, it's a real privilege for us to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking time out to talk to us. I know you and Dad have known each other for a while, but I think I first came across you about just under 10 years ago when a project you were working on called Ethics and Empire became kind of suddenly sucked into the UK culture war. Yeah. Would you mind just explaining a little bit about what that project was and how it became so controversial so quickly?
Yes, Tim. So, I mean, in the course of my career as a Christian ethicist, I have taken to trying to make sense of complex moral issues like war and like making peace and doing justice after civil conflict and rights. The topic of colonialism first came onto my radar when, during the referendum on whether Scotland should separate itself from the UK, whether the UK should disintegrate in 2014, I observed that some Scottish nationalists were making the claim that Scotland should leave Britain because Britain equals empire equals evil. And so Scottish independence, Scottish secession would amount to an act of national self-purification. As an Anglo-Scot, I was a natural opponent of independence, but I did feel as a Christian, since I don't think that nations are forever, nations are not God. It was conceivable that the United Kingdom had come to the end of its shelf life, its justifiable shelf life, and the Scottish nationalists were right. That's why I considered their arguments. But this argument that Britain equals empire equals evil, therefore Scotland needs to purify itself, didn't make sense to me because I just spent 20 years reading about British imperial history. And I knew that the simple equation, empire equals evil, is not historically or morally tenable. But it was then, Tim, that I realized that history, colonial history, was being used for what I regarded as destructive political purposes. And the idea came into my head then that someone needed to correct the record. So that was 2014. My first step toward correcting the record was to design a research project with a very eminent historian of empire, John Darwin, in Oxford, under the title Ethics and Empire. And what we planned to do over a period of 5 years was to look at how people in the past, ancient Hebrews, early Christians, ancient Chinese people or medieval Muslims, how did they regard the empires of their day? Did they regard empire in the same way we do, which is usually negative? And if they didn't see empire as a negative thing, why not? And what might we learn from it? I mean, the great benefit of confronting the past is its difference. And sometimes the difference makes us reflect on ourselves and think, well, okay, if as I think, Jesus and St. Paul in the New Testament were not anti-imperialist, contrary to what some biblical scholars claim, why not? We are. Why weren't they? And what does their position have to tell us?
And did you ever have any inkling at the time that you might be stirring up a hornet's nest?
Stepping onto a landmine.
That was a hate figure of the left.
John, I was completely naive. I knew my views were not popular in some parts. I mean, I published an article in the London Times in November 17, which was one of the things that precipitated my being dragged into the culture wars, in which I argued what I thought to be the completely incontrovertible position that we British can find in our imperial history cause for both pride and shame and pride. I mean, who could possibly disagree with that, I thought to myself. But then, yes, I was quickly disabused that this was an acceptable thing to say in certain quarters.
And why did you think it was important that a Christian ethicist, I mean, a lot of your previous work had looked at things around euthanasia or kind of, as you say, just war theory. Why did you think this should be an ethics project rather than simply a kind of project for the colonial historians to dig into the archives and have a think themselves?
Well, that's a good question, Tim. Well, first of all, it's a moral question. I mean, the question is, I mean, the charge made against our ancestors in Britain is that they were racist, they were oppressive and exploitative. That sums up the empire. So 400 years of our history is racism, oppression and exploitation. That's why we have to pull down statues and decolonize. That's why we have to remove white males from breeding lists and put in not so white folk. So it was a moral question. The charge made against our ancestors, some of them quite recent, some of them still living, actually, was it a just charge? So that was one reason. The second reason I chose this topic was because, as I've grown older, Tim, I've come out as a British patriot. And you can talk. We can talk about that.
Gosh, that's a big thing, isn't it? That's a much bigger thing than to come out in other areas.
John, your reaction confirms my view that what, for example, is completely unremarkable in the United States, the notion that a certain kind of, we can argue about what patriotism is, but most Americans are patriotic, whether on the left or the right. No one questions that. But all my life, and I'm 70 years old, I grew into consciousness in the 60s and 70s. I've been aware that to say I'm a British patriot is akin to saying I'm a fascist. And at a certain point, I always knew that there was something, frankly, unhealthy about that. And in my older age, I've just got fed up with tolerating a very unhealthy, unbalanced appreciation of what we in this country of the United Kingdom, of what we've inherited and of what we're responsible for. And we can talk about, you know, whether a Christian should take that position or not. But I think, as long as I've been a Christian, I've actually also been a patriot. It's just that I've In my older age, I've ceased to worry about what people think. I say so.
What is your Christian ethic of the nation, if I can ask? I mean, we had someone on this show not so long ago who was talking about nations as this, you know, imagined communities that were largely came into being in the 1900s. In the 19th century, and that actually, as Christians, we belong to a kind of transnational, superseding, you know, citizenship is in heaven, not on these kind of man-made structures. What's your own kind of Christian theology of the nation, in a nutshell?
Sure. If I can seize this opportunity for a commercial advertisement, I could ask you to read my book, Between Kin and Cosmopolis, The Ethic of a Nation. An Ethic of a Nation, published 2014. But I'll save you the trouble and summarize you. First of all, I think that the other person who has spoken to you, who gave you their view of what Christians should think, I just observe that Christian view matches the zeitgeist, the globalist zeitgeist exactly. It's not prophetic. It's actually mirroring what most progressive people think. My view is, I'd agree with your globalist Christian that nations are not forever. Absolutely. The nations are not divine. The United Kingdom didn't exist before, 1801. The United States almost came apart in the 1860s during the Civil War, and Czechoslovakia ceased to exist in 1993. So nations are not forever. I get that. And yes, so nations are created. And in that sense, nations are artificial. But nations, nation states can also embody really valuable things, liberties, humanity, and they're embodied in institutions. The UN doesn't. I mean, the UN, to some extent, embodies good values. But the UN only has so much power as nation states give it. And the nation state is the basic unit in international relations. I don't think maybe some people think we should get beyond the nation state to some kind of global government, but we ain't there yet. And frankly, I don't see China buying that unless China is in charge. And some people might like China to be in charge. I personally wouldn't. So we're going to have it. We're going to have a world full of competing nation states and alliances, and I think the globalist utopia is just that. God knows what form the kingdom of God will take on earth, but I don't want it to be a global state, because if there were a single global state, there would be no point of effective resistance, and that's one step away from global tyranny. I think a certain relative patriotism is internally appropriate. We should care for our communities. And caring for them doesn't mean you approve of everything they do. In fact, I often say that if you love something, it can disappoint you deeply, and therefore you can be deeply critical because you love it. If you don't care, you don't criticize it, because it frankly doesn't matter. A qualified loyalty to a nation under God, therefore a critical loyalty, is deeply Christian.
So can I just explore this a bit further, because this is way outside my area of competence, as you well know. My understanding is that what the creation of the modern concept of the nation state is that it makes very real and rigid borders, that there is this clear demarcation. By definition, once you have a nation state, you have borders, and effectively this bit is ours and that bit is yours, and we have the right to control our borders. And it just reflecting on the sort of tensions that we are facing at the moment in terms of immigration and all the rest, a lot of it seems to be related to the concept of borders, isn't it? And the at least that's my naive. Is there something in that?
Yeah. So just going back to what Tim said earlier about this notion that the modern nation state was born in the 1800s. No, modern nationalism was born. but as the Catholic historian Adrian Hastings pointed out decades ago, and of course, I mean, England was a nation state in the, 1,000 years ago. So that's not new. What was new was modern secularized romantic nationalism, in which, yes, the nation takes the place of God. In fact, the nation becomes divine. And I often quote from the German romantic nationalist Fichte, where he says that, you know, the nation, in identifying with the nation, the individual gains immortality because the nation is forever. So the nation becomes, so that was modern and also anti-Christian. But the nation state, I mean, nation states go back long before that. In terms of borders, yes, of course. It might seem that having borders is a bad thing because it keeps people out. Problem is, in the real world, a world full of people who don't necessarily trust each other because they speak different languages and have different customs and feel under threat. In the real world, if you don't have borders, you have wars. So the statement, that line in the by the American poet, was it Frost, about good fences make good neighbors. That's also true. And you know, borders are defensive things. They're designed to prevent people invading you. And we in these islands, because of the wall of sea around us, you know, we've not been invaded in 1,000 years. But if you go to a place like Hungary, where I've been recently, or anywhere in Central Europe, Ukraine, I mean, constant invasion, constant disruption, because powerful neighbors overcame their borders. Look what's happening in Ukraine right now. So although borders do keep people out, there are some people who deserve to be kept out. The question is, who ought want to allow in? And my view is, John, that yes, of course, we should permit immigrants to come here and asylum seekers. That's not the question. The question is how many, from where, and how suddenly. Those are the questions.
I'd like to come back to migration a bit later on, because I think that's a really critical issue at the moment. But just staying for a second on this idea of an ethic of the nation, do you think that nations, while man-made, can be units in which God is kind of interested in? So some Christians believe that part of our discipleship, part of our mandate as believers, is to try and Christianize our nations, to shape their laws and their cultures and their institutions to be as Christian as possible. Whereas other believers say, no, God is not interested in nations. God is interested in people. We create these things because it's a practical way to organize lives, but no one is saved through a nation. It's all through on a more individual, local level.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, it's difficult to read the Old Testament, which is part of the Christian Bible, without thinking that nations are important to God. Quite difficult. And the other thing is that all human beings are born into communities. Now, they may not be nations. They may just be tribes or clans or tribes, and then tribes become peoples. I mean, nations are a big collections of tribes. So we start with a community, and the community, often for defensive purposes, gets bigger. There's no one on earth who doesn't live in a national community. Now, you know, it may be that national communities will join together and become the EU, as the American colonies became the United States. So national communities can eventually sink their sovereignty into a larger unit. But the EU is not transnational. It's a new nation with borders facing east toward Russia, south toward the Med and west toward the US. So nations, through their institutions and their laws, nation states shape the lives of individuals enormously, for good or ill. And those laws, institutions can be deeply inhumane, deeply oppressive, deeply intrusive, deeply liberal, or they can be the opposite. And I think the Christians have a stake in institutions, national institutions. Yes, of course, we also have a stake in international institutions. So this is not exclusive. And I'm not saying that all our love should be, not all our love should be poured into a nation state, because nation states are not God. And the church, yes, is a transnational body, which is a useful corrective against any tendency to idolize the nation. But churches exist within nation states. And some nation states can be accommodating, and some can be deeply unaccommodating to churches. So it matters what the nation state is.
As we near the end of the year, I want to pause and thank God for how he's worked through Premier Insight in 2025. From honest conversations on Unbelievable to the wisdom of N.T. Wright, this ministry has helped thousands grow in faith, defend truth, and engage culture with grace. But none of this happens without you. Right now, Premier Insight faces a $106,497 funding gap that must be closed by December the 31st. And thanks to a generous $25,000 challenge grant, your gift today will go even further to equip believers and reach seekers in 2026. Visit premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. And now, back to today's episode. Before the rush takes over, start your Christmas journey with Premier's Advent Moments interactive calendar. Open each door and step into the unfolding story of Jesus with daily challenges rooted in kindness and a verse that brings you closer to Bethlehem. You'll also receive short emails of encouragement to help you stay centered through Advent. Sign up at premier.org.uk/advent2025. Brought to you by Sat7 UK. You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
It's interesting just thinking back to the New Testament period, because it's often been pointed out, isn't it, that there's a very complex relationship between the nascent Christian church and the Roman Empire. And there's a contrast between Paul in Romans enjoining submission to the emperor, and then in the book of Revelation, where the Roman Empire has become the beast and is a source of great evil.
No, that's right. And that's why I say that it's wrong to say that the New Testament is anti-imperialist, because actually, within the pages of the New Testament, you get a variety of stances. So you're quite right. The Apocalypse, the Revelation to St. John, is deeply critical and hostile to Rome as Babylon. So we learn from that empires, and indeed nation states, can become seriously oppressive and evil. You know, think Nazi Germany. But on the other hand, you know, you do have Paul in Romans 13, as you said, John, enjoining Christians to obey the authorities which are ordained by God, to curb evil by use of the sword. That's what states are all basically about. And then in the Acts of the Apostles, well, in the Gospels and the Acts of the Apostles, I think doesn't Jesus and the apostles come across centurions three times, or four times? On each occasion, the centurion is vaunted as an epitome of faith, and on no occasion is the centurion told to stop his profession. And you know, I when I first began thinking about these things, I observed that according to the Gospels, those who drove Jesus to his death were the, if you like, the indigenous authorities, the Jews, the Jewish religious authorities, who stirred up their mob. Pilate, the representative of the Roman Empire, was their kind of weak tool. So actually, the Gospels present us with a situation where what's wrong about empire is it was too weak, not too strong. It failed to resist a gross injustice. So I think in the pages of the New Testament, you get a variety of different stances, and that's quite right, because I think one should respond to nation states or empires according to the circumstances and according to what they are, but not just assume because this is a nation state, because it's an empire, therefore, as such, it's evil. That's not true.
And when the Roman Empire several centuries later kind of converted to Christianity, there was a sense of excitement among a lot of church figures who thought this was the kind of fulfillment of God's plan, that this, what was it in the known world, kind of this global empire, the closest we've ever come probably to a kind of single world government, suddenly being captured for Christ. And yet, I think the Christianity I've grown up in has been quite skeptical of that Christendom era that was birthed out of that, and that, you know, Western Europe was shaped by. And a lot of Christians I read and listened to growing up actually said that it's healthy to turn the page on Christendom. It's healthy. It's better for the church to go back to those early years as a kind of small remnant opposed by a secular kind of national or transnational power. That's the model that we see in Acts, and it's a better way to be, rather than having your church muddying the waters by having these blurred lines with the state.
Well, indeed, yeah. And isn't the eminent Lord bigger? Isn't he a representative of Christendom?
Yes.
Yes,
an ordained priest in our established church, also sitting in our upper House, yeah, of Lords.
I confess, I'm guilty, my lord. Guilty, fully guilty. So it's true that when Christianity became tolerated and then became the official religion in the Roman Empire in the 4th century, that you have people like Eusebius and Orosius thinking that the kingdom of God has landed. But you also have in the early 5th century people like St. Augustine of Hippo saying, no, we live in between the resurrection, which is the token of what is to come, and the fulfillment of what is to come at the end of history. We live in the ambiguous time, the secular time, the saeculum, the time of ambiguity, the time of the mixing up of things, the time when the church is not perfect, and nor is the Christianized state perfect. Both are subject to the judgment of God. And so, yes, I mean, Christianity's dominance of the West led to abuses. On the other hand, it also led eventually to the abolition of slavery, first time in the history of the world. It led to the mitigation of punishments. In other words, it also achieved some positive things. So I don't doubt that established Christianity suffers temptations. But I do think it's a good thing if Christianity has more influence over institutions and laws than not. But just one more thing. And so, you know, if need be, then you know, if for example, the British Parliament decided to abolish the established church, if we were thrown back on our own resources and went back to the first century position of living in small communities, so be it. We witness in that way. On the other hand, the small gathered church is also subject to temptations. The temptation to think that it's pure and everyone else is outside is impure. The temptation to think that what happens outside of its own closed doors doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. There are temptations on all sides.
Mm-hmm. And just to come nearer to the present and talk a bit about America, but my understanding is that the foundation of the United States, there was this strong sense of American exceptionalism, that we were now the city on the hill that was to be a beacon to the world. Is that accurate? Is that true? Or is that a caricature?
No. Certainly, I'm thinking of early Puritan Americans. I'm just right now reading Antonia Fraser's fantastic biography of Oliver Cromwell. But you'll find Puritan Christians of that period thinking the same of England. Taking their model from the chosen people of God, namely Israel. So that's right, and. Just as far as the US is concerned, in certain respects, it's not untrue. Without the US, Nazi Germany and Japan and Imperial Japan would have prevailed, well, probably, in the Second World War. And the US, notwithstanding all its many, 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 many flaws, remains a champion of political liberty. In a way that Russia and China and Iran are certainly not. It's dangerous and presumptuous and hubristic, isn't it, to think of your nation as the chosen people permanently. And indeed, the Old Testament prophets like Amos lambasted Israel for presuming that. He said, you think you're chosen? Well, what about this tribe and that tribe? They're all chosen. So it's dangerous, but I do think, nevertheless, we Christians should want our nation states to be vehicles of, if not directly the gospel, then of the kind of attitudes and ethics that the gospel generates. So I'm very glad that the British state.
So we've talked on the podcast before about. The recent rise, which seems to be really originating within the US, but coming across the Atlantic, of this link between a right-wing political agenda,
yeah,
and Christian concerns for reforming the state, for being an influence, and so on.
Yes.
And I'd be interested in your perspective on that, both on its origins and on the influence it's having across the world.
Yes, I've not followed developments in the States very closely, John. But yes, that's my. I'm aware that Christian nationalism is a thing in America. And I'm aware of lots of Christians who are critical of it. And I did attend and spoke at the first London meeting of, what was it, National Conservatism.
ARC.
This is separate. National Conservatism. That the American-Israeli scholar Yoram Hazony, I guess, has generated. He's written a book about nationalism. Yes, and as a Christian patriot, I as I've said, I do think a certain valuing of the nation is Christian, there are certain versions of Christian nationalism of which I'm really quite wary. And I believe in the United States there are some integrist Roman Catholics who really think that I guess Roman Catholic Christianity ought to be imposed through the state. I'm in favour of establishment light here in Britain as we've inherited it for a number of reasons. Although I don't think the world would collapse. I don't think the church would collapse if we didn't have establishment light. I've heard recently Robert Toombs, the historian, was in some kind of dispute with some young English nationalists, I think they were academics and they may have been Christian, who were of the view that you can't be English unless you are so ethnically English. So brown-skinned people can't really be English. And I find that not only bizarre, but I find it really dangerous, such a notion. So Christian nationalism can go in some very dubious and dangerous directions. I don't doubt that. The danger is that other Christians will react and say, well, they will react in a globalist direction and say, well, we need to repudiate the nation or at least dissociate ourselves. I think that's also wrong. So I end up, although I have a reputation, as you know, John and Tim, for being a right-wing fanatic, I always actually occupy the middle ground for those who serve. And here I do too. But yes, I mean, why might it be that an upsurge in nationalism is supported by lots of Christians? Well, I guess I'd have to look into myself and ask myself, what's Christian about my patriotism? And I think it's partly it's what's Christian about my conservatism. I think I've always had a sense that in this country we have inherited a precious legacy. We also inherited problems, but we've inherited a precious legacy, which our ancestors spent blood and treasure and lives to build, and we have a duty to take care of it and improve it, and not to scorn it and not to take it for granted. And I think that's a Christian disposition, because we're not gods, we're creatures, and we should be grateful for what we receive. And we should love it enough to take care of it critically under God. But no, the nation is not God, and not England is not God.
I wonder what you make of the argument that I increasingly come across from Christian conservatives in this country, which is that there is something fundamental about Englishness, which is bound up with Christianity, and a lot of the problems our country is facing is because it is drifting away and abandoning and jettisoning that Christian legacy, whether it's cultural, moral, spiritual, historical, institutional, but actually as we, this idea that we're a cut flower society, you know, you can cut a flower off from its roots and for a period of time it still looks healthy, but eventually the petals will drop. And the argument goes, it's because Britain has been cut from its Christian heritage and roots, yep, and secularized, it's now experiencing this kind of tumult.
Yes. I mean, on the one hand, no, of course, Christianity is not essential to Englishness, because there was a time when Englishmen were pagans. So we, you know, we can become pagan English, but we don't, we're not the same Englishmen. By the way, I'm British, not English.
Quite right.
But I agree. I think the rubbishing and disposal of our Christian heritage, and as it were, the Christianization of Englishness and Britishness is a dangerous and unhealthy thing. You know, we think we can take away all the humane and liberal values that that Christianity has helped to promote, I think that we're discovering we can't do that. I think we're discovering that. For example, here in the House, here in the Lords, a bill has come up to us that is saying that we should decriminalize the killing of human embryos up to birth by women. And I noticed the way in which those advocates treat the embryo as if it was absolutely nothing, if it was just a piece of, I don't know, tissue or whatever. And I'm thinking to myself, although in this case the advocates are deeply concerned about the dignity of women, the way in which they're promoting that cause is profoundly dehumanizing of what they're carrying in their womb. And I'm thinking, well, this is perhaps another indication of what happens when you completely lose sight of certain Christian principles. I've also noticed that the temper of convinced wokists or progressives is, on the one hand, they seem to have embodied the prophetic ire of the Old Testament prophets, their prophecy against injustice. On the other hand, they appear to have no sense that sin lies here, not just there. And so their criticism is completely lacking in mercy, because you're evil. And by the way, because you're evil, I can fight you by any means at all. And so I see this as a kind of degenerate Christianity. And what's happening is we're becoming less liberal, less tolerant, less willing to engage with each other with courage and love and patience. I think those who say that Britain cutting itself off from its Christian roots is literally losing its moorings, I think that's probably right. I don't think they quite lost, by the way. I think that Britain is in a mixed position. Times. And actually, I think secularism is not as confident now as it was 30 years ago.
I think we're running out of time, and obviously we could talk about this for many times. It's completely fascinating. I wonder if I could just ask you on a personal note. You now are in a very powerful position as a member of the House of Lords. You're well known as a Christian, a public Christian. Do you find yourself steering a line between when you are speaking as a Christian with distinctively Christian agenda, and when you are speaking as a legislator who is working for the good of the community, for the common good, and so on? Do you find that a conflict in your role?
Yes and no, not a conflict. I mean, I think on particular issues, I come to moral conclusions, whether it's on assisted suicide, whether it's on abortion, whether it's on war, whether it's on we should give away the Chagos Islands to Mauritius, which is what I'm talking about this afternoon. I come to conclusions, and I always come to conclusions as a Christian ethicist. And if a Christian wants me to explain why is this Christian, I will do so. But it's not, you know, there are contexts where that's not the question, and it's not appropriate for me to explain it in those terms. So no one in the Chamber of the House of Lords is going to ask me how is that Christian. But I won't tell them. But I will tell them the conclusion, and I will tell them some of the reasoning. And if someone in the bar or the corridor afterwards wants to say, well, you're a priest, why is that Christian? I mean, for example, I publicly criticized in the press the stance taken by the bishops of the Church of England on the Conservative government's a proposal to divert illegal migrants to Rwanda. I thought the plan was severe but moral. The bishops thought it was immoral. So I can imagine if I were making that point, if I was pushing that line here in the chamber, some bishops or some Christian peers might come up to me and say, Nigel, that's not Christian. And I say, well, here's why it's Christian. But it's really, I don't feel the need, as it were, to hide what I think. Hmm. It's a question of, I think lots of things. It's not appropriate on every occasion to say it all.
Indeed. Yes.
But I don't feel as it were, schizophrenic about it.
Hmm. And I think that tallies with us in much less exalted positions. I was actually, by coincidence, just last week, I was interviewing a Christian MP in the House of Commons on a similar topic, and she told me, I've been a Christian my whole life. I don't know what, you know, Rebecca Smith MP would think if she wasn't a Christian. I can't kind of take on and off these Christian spectacles. It's part of who I am. It shapes every fibre of my discernment, my wisdom, my judgment, my morality.
Yes, no, I agree with that. I agree with that.
Well, I'm afraid we talked about these things for many hours, but I'm afraid we have to let you get on to your next appointments. But thank you so much for coming on the show, Nigel. It's been really fascinating digging into some of these big issues. If people want to find out a bit more about your thinking on colonialism, I think you published a book, didn't you, out of that Ethics and Empire Project. Can you just tell people where they could find that?
Yes, so the book's called Colonialism, A Moral Reckoning, published in 2023 with an additional postscript to the paperback edition 2024. Available on Amazon. More recently, in September, I published a book called Reparations, Slavery and the Tyranny of Imaginary Guilt, published by Swift, and that again is available on Amazon or in Waterstones.
Great. Well, yes, recommend people go and engage with some of Nigel's thinking on that. Thanks everyone for listening. If you've got any comments or responses, we'd love to hear what listeners are thinking to what we've been talking about today. You can get in touch by emailing molad, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. And as always, there's lots of things to read on Dad's website as well. That's johnwyatt.com. But otherwise, we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable. Before the rush takes over, start your Christmas journey with Premier's Advent Moments interactive calendar. Open each door and step into the unfolding story of Jesus with daily challenges rooted in kindness and a verse that brings you closer to Bethlehem. You'll also receive short emails of encouragement to help you stay centered through Advent. Sign up at premier.org.uk/advent2025. Brought to you by Sat7 UK.